Chris, normally there are about four or five of us up here.
Right.
It's just two of us, and it's awfully intimate. That's the plus side. The minuses will emerge as we go along.
Okay.
Welcome, everybody. Thank you again for coming along. This is the fourth in the Young Leader series that MJCC and CEDA have put together. For many of you, you would have come along and seen a journey. In the first of the series, we looked at entrepreneurship. We were interested in thinking about and acting on emerging opportunities and how entrepreneurs both see and pursue those opportunities. In the second of the series, we touched on marketing, advertising and PR, and we explored the differences between them and how organisations are responding to shifts in their marketplace and the market space. In the third, we touched on the MBA, the value of it to young people as they progress in their careers. Today we're interested in trends. Today we're really wanting to think about how one conceives the future and responds to it. There's three basic things we want to do today, Chris. Firstly, get to know you, try to understand who Chris Sanderson is, what you're about, and then touch on the Future Laboratory. What is the Future Laboratory? What does it do? How does it work? And then cascade that into an approach that we could think about in terms of how we see the future and how we respond to the future. Is that a fair call?
Sounds good.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you.
Tell us about Chris Sanderson.
Well, I guess I'm just about able to be here. I'm 38. So I fit into the age demographic fine. I am an entrepreneur. I have had a career in marketing and public relations and journalism. I don't think I know what MBA stands for.
Master of Business Administration. It's a degree that boring people like me tend to do.
Oh, okay. That's probably the gap in my experience. I have taught. I taught at an organisation called the London Institute. Sorry, I'll do this too. An organisation called the London Institute, which is Europe's largest art college or conglomeration of art colleges. And I was a teacher there. I taught visual communication for 3 years. I'm just about to be an associate professor at Swinburne in design for retail. So my background really is jack of all trades, to be totally frank. I trained as a theatre director and designer.
Theatre?
Yes. But my dad was a designer, product designer. So, which is my obsession really is with visuals and images and the power of the visual image rather than necessarily the written word. So in the magazine that I do, which is always exactly equal in terms of the number of visuals or the amount of space given over to the visuals as to the written word, I look after all the pictures. And the editor looks after all the words and we don't mess. We kind of, it's very cohesive, but, you know, we are kingdom, you know, kings of our own domains, as it were.
What turns you on?
Lots of things. How much time have we got? Being in Melbourne turns me on, actually.
Why?
I got really excited about coming here this time.
Why?
Because I love it here.
What is it about Melbourne that makes it Melbourne?
Oh, it's cute.
Oh.
No, I mean more than that. No, Melbourne, I think, is still a really pretty dynamic and exciting place to be. I don't go to Sydney much.
Okay.
I find Sydney very vanilla. Melbourne's got a lot more character to it. It's kind of deeper. It's more profound. Artistically, I think it's more exciting. And I think from a business perspective, I get the feeling that people here are more open to change. There's a more conducive atmosphere going on towards, I think, some of the big challenges that Australia will face over the next 5 years.
Okay.
Maybe we'll save that for later.
We will. But can you compare Melbourne to perhaps another city, another global city?
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me a lot of San Francisco, actually. And Barcelona.
Okay.
So often cities that are traditionally regarded as the second city,
yeah.
But I think are probably more creatively exciting and probably actually underneath it where the real drive is occurring.
Second city but not second rate.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about the Future Laboratory. What is it?
Well, as I kind of said, you know, I would say I'm a bit of a jack of all trades. My background is, as I said, in visuals and looking at the visual image. And everything I've done has also been about really understanding what makes people tick. I spent 10 years training as an actor before I then went to look at theatre and design within theatre. Mm. And everything about direction is obviously about understanding human nature and social observation. Because if you can't actually understand what's going through the minds of the people who are trying to create drama on stage, you really haven't got a clue. So everything has to be about character emotional motivation. And I think I learned an awful lot about people from that. About spending the time to actually sit and watch and wonder why it is that something actually makes somebody want to do something. Yeah. But I have inevitably found theatre very boring because I can't stand actors.
Hang on.
They drive me nuts. So I went to work in fashion. And most people think, hey, fashion people are pretty scary. But believe me, fashion people are really, really sane compared to actors.
What is it about actors?
Oh, they're so self-obsessed.
Okay.
And they have no dress sense. Most of them. They haven't got a clue what to wear. No, I mean, that's being facile. But no, they are a very, very funny bunch of people because everything is about this notion of performance and they're so focused off on what they give that they're not often thinking about what's going on around them and they're not often very good at social interaction at all. And I'm quite an outward-going, quite social person, so I did just find dealing with actors, your raw plasticine, actually deeply frustrating. So I had to give it up. I had to move on to something else. So then I kind of moved on to looking at other ways that I could think about things from a visual perspective or a design perspective. I'm a pointing profession person. I don't really get my hands dirty. I stand back and point. That's what I'm really good at.
But for that,
so I couldn't. I'm not a designer. I've never really had any great ambition to become a designer. So I don't look at a stool and go, God, I could design that better. I just look and say, that's shit. Do you know what I mean? So I've already, the ability to criticise or look at something and understand its good points or its bad points is one thing. To then be able to go and make a better stool is a very different talent, which I don't really have.
But presumably, within the Future Laboratory and other places that you've been associated with, there are people that are able to deliver.
Oh, we deliver, but as an agency, we're not, for instance, we work a lot within design, but we don't design product.
Okay.
We come up with solutions, but solutions for us are about insight. But, the Future Laboratory came about because at the time when it was created, my partner and I had created Viewpoint, we'd taken over a magazine that was very fashion and textiles based, and we thought there was a potential to create a magazine that looked at culture, that looked at marketing, that looked at communication in a very broad way. Mm. And after about two or three issues, the phone was always ringing from agencies specifically who obviously didn't have a clue what was going on at the turn of the century, and they would say, can you help us? We're looking for a solution about this. And we finally realized we're onto a good thing here, so instead of just doing the magazine became a client. And we set up a consultancy service, a service provision agency, to actually help both brands and their service providers, advertising agencies, PR companies, marketing agencies, below the line and above the line, all sorts of people involved in the provision of services to brands, to the greater glory of consumerism, to help them understand the shifts that were going on in society, because we could see them as being very profound and very dynamic at a time where we felt a lot of people were still stumbling along, not quite sure how things were going to move or how things were going to change. And I think my background in fashion communications, marketing, design, looking, gave me, and then the people that I started to train around me, an understanding of this basic understanding of what we call visual acuity, which is the ability that we all have, that we've all undergone training to achieve, of being able to see and sense what's going on around us. Most of us in the last 10 years have been aware that the nature of business has gone through profound changes. ICT, information communication technology, has created a world that we now live in with ramifications, because we're not even aware of the changes yet ourselves, that are as profound as the Industrial Revolution 250 years ago. Mm. And yet most of us aren't quite aware of those, because we're living in it, we're adapting to it day by day. Mm. As a result, if you think about it, the nature of what an advertising agency is now is very different from what it was 10 years ago.
Sure.
What a PR company is very different.
Sure.
And what we realized, I think, quite early on was that, and it was very difficult at first, but was that we would actually make money through being able to sell insight to companies at a time when insight was normally the bit that everyone gave away free. You know, a PR company was there to deliver column inches, but at the same time it delivered to its clients information, ideas, inspiration, insight into where the brand should be going. Because the PR would normally be there whispering in the designer's ear or the brand manager's ear, look, you know, why don't you just think, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
And I think advertising agencies have very much always done the same. Mm. And yet the one thing that we begin to understand is their real capital in the 21st century was the one thing that they weren't actually getting paid for. It was for all the other stuff that they accrued around the edges that they were charging for.
Can we take a look at that? Let's talk about the two bits. One is the insight, and the other one is selling insight.
Right.
Talk more about insight. What is it? How do you approach it?
Okay. Insight for us is this process that, you know, information is just information.
Okay,
you have to turn information into knowledge, you have to turn knowledge into wisdom, and part of that process is that you are delivering to somebody a statement or an understanding of something rather than just pure information. A statistic is a piece of information. If you combine a statistic with a sense of understanding its purpose or its point, its place in a point in time, i.e. how it fits in with how people are behaving, then you're delivering insight. Mm. So it was about the ability to take either empirical information or assumed information, put the two together, and actually deliver that with a conclusion to a client that would make them actually think, oh, I see how things could work now. So for us, part of our methodology about then transferring that into an understanding of the future was creating what we call cultural triangulation.
Now, that suggests that there are three parts to it. Cultural, what are they?
Well, you must have been a Boy Scout. If you're a Boy Scout or a Girl Guide, you know how to read a map. And in order to read a map, you have to triangulate. You first have to actually get three coordinates to get your point in the here and now before you then get a fourth coordinate, which is your journey forward.
Okay.
So for us, the process of cultural triangulation was about helping clients and businesses, brands, to understand this is where you are now, this is what you need in order to then push forward, to map the future. So for us, the triangulation points are interrogation, observation, and intuition.
Interrogation, observation, intuition.
Yes.
Run through those.
Okay, well, interrogation, it's about asking questions.
To who?
Well, precisely. Our business was set up as a qualitative agency at a time when marketing was still based on the very bizarre idea that quantitative data would somehow be able to tell you what people in the future were going to want. Now, I've still never got my head around that, but somehow I've been told or led to believe that that's very true, that if I actually take a poll of 25,000 Australian citizens in nice average homes, in nice average parts of the country, with nice average families and nice average incomes, I'll get an idea about the best car for them to drive in 5 years' time. Sorry, I get confused. Don't understand how it works. There's an obsession with quantitative data within business, mainly because it's the prop for companies that are too scared to actually think about what the future might hold and actually think that by relying on numbers, they'll be able to securely think about their future, which, as far as I'm concerned, is bullshit. Because every successful company always operates on the seat of its pants and is led by visionaries who understand that you actually have to take a jump into the future in order to satisfy the consumer of the future. So, for us, interrogation is asking the right questions to the right people. I would rather talk to 10 experts and ask them two questions than talk to 1,000 people with 20 or 50 or 100 questions. You know, give me 5 minutes with somebody who is an expert in that field, and I can find or glean something that will help me better understand their particular field of knowledge. So, for instance, we did a big project for American Express this year for the Centurion card, which is their top-end credit card. And they wanted us to find out what the future would hold in the area of luxury. So we asked 100 of the world's top practitioners within five fields three questions each. And that was it. So it was Alexander McQueen, John Pawson, Alain Senderens, you know, and it was about approaching them in a very straightforward way and getting them to tell us to divulge their vision of the future. Because we felt from that, I could get a far better understanding of what the future might hold than asking 1,000 American Express card holders. So that's interrogation for us. Okay. It's about the right question to the right person.
Observation is one of the others, right?
Observation. I've kind of already obviously spent quite a bit of time talking about how I feel about visuals. We're still a culture that becomes even more focused on this idea of reading and writing. You know, what is our primary source of communication these days? It's the thumb. We probably use the thumb more than any other kind of form or mode of expression for communicating messages. And, you know, here we were 10 years ago, we were told that the internet and computers are going to be the death of expression, of language, and totally the reverse has happened. You know, people write to each other more than they probably ever have in living history. In any form of history, actually, in social history. We write to each other obsessively. Now, the quality of that writing is another matter, but that's kind of not what we're here to discuss. But we are still obsessed with words. We're still obsessed with language. And yet, from the day that we're born, we have two ears, we have two eyes, and we watch and look around us. And everything that we do is based on a process of learning that I sincerely believe is more about how we look at things than how we hear. That, in fact, what we see around us is what teaches us how to interact with people, what is right, what is wrong, how we behave, how we engage with other human beings, how we engage with our environment all the time. So this process of visual acuity, of learning, is something that we all have. It's an innate skill because we don't walk around bumping into people and we don't walk around normally abusing people and actually being socially inept. Most of us are actually incredibly social beings, even if we think we're not. We know how to respond to human beings. And so this skill that we all have is something that I think is actually vastly underrated and deeply underused within most businesses. I mean, so for us, the whole process of kind of social anthropology isn't something you learn at university. It's something we all go through every day. It's just we don't use it and we don't think about it. I mean, one of the jobs or one of the tasks that we set a lot of our clients is that we teach them or we tell them to go to a supermarket with the sole purpose of buying nothing. Because how many people here have ever been to a supermarket to browse? You don't browse lettuce. You know, you don't browse Pampers. You browse in a record shop or a clothes shop or a bookshop, but you don't browse in a supermarket. And so the fascinating thing about supermarkets is you get people who are completely normally in the here and now. They are in that moment, living in the present, shopping, totally engaged in being distracted by the packaging of that product, by the offer, by the smell, by the texture, by whatever it is that's grabbing their attention. They are so in the here and now, they reveal enormous amounts about themselves. Because there's none of the normal kind of barriers going on about, ooh, you know, does my bum look good in this? You know, how do I look when I'm walking through the shop, when I walk out of the dressing room? You know, do I look like I'm intelligent because I've picked up this book? You know, your brain just isn't going through those same kind of processes. So go to a supermarket and just stand back and watch. And watch how people behave. And within 5 minutes, you will be able to make up entire stories about these people. And I would reckon about 80% of the time, you're right. You'll know which district of Melbourne they'll come from. You'll know roughly what their partner looks like, if they've got one. You'll know roughly what kind of car they drive, what food they're likely to buy from what they've already put in their basket, how many kids they've got if they've got kids, probably what their kids' names are, what kind of school they go to, what kind of telly programs they like, what music they like. You will have formed opinions about all of those things, and I would reckon most of the time you are right. Always judge a book by its cover.
Let's turn to intuition.
Again, really underrated.
Go on.
Trust your gut. About 98% of the time, trust your gut. Because it's the rock bed of your own creative experience that you are slowly building up throughout your life, both in a professional career and also in a life capacity. So if your gut tells you something is wrong, it's wrong. It's not right. For us, the trick is learning in that process of triangulation to take that gut feeling, that very human ability to sense something, and actually marry it with slightly more astute forms of observation or interrogation, where you are engaging your brain, you're engaging your creative ability, you're engaging your facility to make sound judgment, to then come up with what we think is often a pretty good assumption or understanding of where things are now that will help to influence where something might be in the future. And we think that's far more reliable than any quant data can ever tell you.
With that in mind, you must come across a range of issues from a range of quarters. What are some of the key themes that are emerging now in terms of perceptions about the future?
Ooh, where would you want to begin? I think one thing for us is we've talked a lot recently about polarization of people,
mm-hmm.
about this idea of the split between being either very pro something or anti. So smoking, for example, mm-hmm. as an example, the ability at which most of us have adapted to not smoking within social arrangements, and I think even hardened smokers now actually feel pretty good about the fact they'll come to something like this, and it's now seemed to be socially acceptable not to smoke in these environments. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's funny, I was sitting outside a cafe just yesterday with a mum with her two daughters, and it was outside, perfectly acceptable for her to smoke. She kind of pulled a cigarette out of her bag, and before she'd even lit it, her two 12, 13-year-old daughters were kind of doing this before mother had even lit the cigarette. And she was just made to feel like a complete social pariah and just, you know, kind of stood off the little cafe bit and went and walked up and down the street like some real sad individual, you know, with this desperate habit. Mm. I am an ex-smoker. China will ban smoking overnight. China will do the sums and they will suddenly say smoking is unacceptable in China. Bang, there you go, BAT. That's their strategy for the next 25 years out of the window. It wouldn't surprise me. Do you see what I mean? So there's a sense emerging in our culture where it's okay to ban things and be really, really, really kind of dogmatic about things. Yeah. But then there's this other side where everything is leaning towards this idea that we've got to be more liberal, we have to be more open, it's about agreement, it's about saying yes to stuff. You know, if that's what you do, that's fine by us. You know, tolerance is great. So, but this split that we're seeing between what is deemed to be acceptable and what is deemed to be unacceptable, I think is very interesting. And how it polarizes. Because we've been through a decade, really, that was totally the other way. You know, the 90s, that beige decade that Taste forgot. You know, where everything was about agreeing. You know, our politics was third way, whether you were here, whether you were in the US, whether you were in the UK or most of Europe. It was all about agreeing. Our music culture was about agreeing. We lived in Britney World. You know, from the age of 15 to 65, everyone was supposed to like the same music and kind of, you know. And our drugs were about agreeing. You know, our drugs were about everyone kind of getting on in some lovely, happy, vibey environment. Mm. And so everything was designed to make everyone feel that they were all sort of together and happy. And the nice thing about the noughts, of course, is we're seeing dissension again. We're beginning to see teens who are behaving like teens and, you know, having music and trends that none of us can understand and really want to, which is great. That's really healthy. Mm. And we're seeing, I think, again, also generational issues come about where people are beginning to think it's about time to grow up or it's about time to be separate. You know, if you are in your late 30s now, especially I think with a lot of guys, they're kind of beginning to feel that maybe it's time they put those board shorts away. The last time they actually got on a surfboard was about 10 years ago. And so I think there's a sense of responsibility in growing up which is affecting lots of different age groups that's making them more polarized. Mm. So that's certainly one thing that we're seeing. Okay. After a period of blur, a sense of polarization.
Changing direction a little.
Yeah.
A lot of people would be very interested in your views on emerging industries and emerging businesses. Tell us a bit about that. Based on the work that you've done, what is to come?
Well, certainly the continued growth of service provision is a critical thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the reasons why we probably were able to do what we did is that London, I think, is still the capital of service provision. When our manufacturing industries were decimated almost to the point of non-existence in the late 70s and into the 80s, I think as a country, we very quickly adapted to what else we could do. You know, that idea of Britain being a nation of shopkeepers. So service provision actually for us was second nature. And I think we were ideally placed at that point to suddenly blossom and to embrace, again, ICT, the information communication technology boom that was happening at that time, and to understand how we needed to adapt in that way. Mm. And the next generation that's happening in the UK is of the creative industries, the move and the shift from being about service provision to being about creative delivery. Mm. I think we're only just beginning to understand how consumers in the next 10 or 15 years are actually going to have the choice that they've never had before. Think about the work that Chris Anderson has written about in The Long Tail, his book that came out this year. He's the editor of Wired magazine, describing this whole idea of the endless possibility of choice, which is what he says, that the huge shift that we'll see in retail over the next 15 years is the move or the collapse of the mass and the desire to have mass to the ability that we all have now to actually buy into the long tail, that smaller and smaller decreasing availability of niche product or unique product. Mm. You know, the idea that Amazon as an online bookstore has 6 million books on its shelves. An average bookshop has 130,000. And yet the majority of Amazon sales are not in its volume, its body. They're in its long tail. That's why we go there. That's what we really want to buy. We're not really interested in mass anymore. Mm. And at a point in our history, in our manufacturing history, where product is no longer something you drop on your foot, which is the old explanation of product, I can't drop AOL on my foot. I can't drop Amazon or eBay on my foot. I can't drop Second Life on my foot. Mm. And yet I can have a tangible relationship with those brands. Our sense of brand is shifting. And then critically, our manufacturing that still exists is most definitely shifting. We are now on the point where almost any industry can mass customize any product. So your trainers no longer have to be one of 5 million pairs. Your car is no longer one of 30,000. Your toothbrush is no longer one of 6 million. Manufacturing is reaching the point through digitization where each and every one that rolls off the production line has the possibility to be slightly changed or altered to actually be unique and to your specification. So everything is going to become consumer specific. That has an enormous effect on how we think as consumers about our ability to engage with brands. So hence the rise of a society based on collaboration, a far more federated approach to how we do business. Mm. So traditional hierarchical models of business just don't matter anymore, nor do traditional ideas of a customer service department or an R&D department, because the consumer is actively engaging with the process of the creation of the product and may actually be two steps ahead of the R&D department. So brands are going to go through an enormous period of change over the next 10 or 15 years, as we've already begun to see with some of them.
We've started to see that.
Yeah.
What else is there to come? Brands and the way that they are represented, the way that they're perceived is shifting, as you're saying.
Yeah,
You're describing the rise of this whole creative industry, which is not the creation of the creative industry. It's just the shift there. What does it mean for businesses, for people within businesses, for careers, etc., going forward?
Well, the careers thing is a slightly different thing. Maybe we'll come back to that. I think within structures of business. I think any business that doesn't understand the role of creativity and the importance of right brain thinking is probably on its knees already. Look at General Motors Holden or probably Ford or any of the other big, I'm sorry, struggling with one of the other big car companies in General Motors in the US. Mm-hmm. You know, because they're still thinking about 20th century ways of manufacturing a car in a 21st century environment, which just doesn't work. So the rise of the creative consumer means that you have to have a creative business plan and you have to think creatively about what your future will be. It's the difference between being Dell and being Apple. Now, whilst Dell might still control 85% of the consumer, you know, and both consumer and business computing market, do we honestly believe that they will in 25 years' time?
Do you?
No, absolutely not.
What do you see?
Well, you know, look, one in seven kids in Europe has an iPod in their back pocket.
Sure.
Now, what effect does that have on a kid when they finally get to the age where they have to have a laptop to take to college or university? Are they going to want a Dell? Or are they going to want an iPod, an iMac, or an iBook, or the next generation of those computers? Mm. You know, I think you've got a generation of creativity there and a collaboration in terms of understanding a product that leads you to actually desire certain types of products in a different kind of way. But you're also talking about a business that has been run on a creative model. It might be quite dictatorial at times, but it's still about an understanding of the creative push of the product, the creative push of the people behind the product. Mm. So I think it's very clear at this point in history to determine brands that are, you know, have a successful future and those that are going to have a real struggle on their hands if they want to survive in a different market. So that the underlying sense of the role of creativity is really important. Allowing people within a business structure to be creative. Again, there's this awful thing that happens in business, which is the idea that that's the design department, that's where the creative people are, and that everyone else somehow isn't creative. And yet, in order to be successful in business, you have to be creative. You have to think creatively, you have to behave creatively, you have to continue to be creative every day. Because whether you're dealing with math and you're dealing with numbers or you're dealing with people, unless you're coming up with creative solutions, you're not actually meeting emotional need. And this is the other problem with business, is most business is still based on the idea that it's about numbers. Mm. Talk to any good economist and they'll tell you actually it's all about the irrational nature of human beings, which is a very different focus.
These interactions, can you touch specifically on the interaction with the customer?
Mm.
How will that change? How will that evolve over time?
Well, I think ICT, again, to keep using that phrase, has an enormous effect on this. The ability that we have to actually engage with product, even if we don't touch it, I think is something we're beginning to understand. You know, even luxury brands, I do a lot of work in the luxury goods industry, they were the first ones to poo-poo the internet because they thought people would never get involved because they couldn't actually touch the product. And touching the product was essential to actually wanting to buy a luxury product. Mm. And yet, products like Fendi with their baguette or Gucci or Prada have had enormous success in sales online because you don't need to necessarily touch a Fendi baguette to actually be a consumer, an active consumer who wants one. In fact, what's more important is that you're able to search and comparative price shop and locate and actually facilitate the process of acquiring that piece of product and do that globally.
Mm.
And that's what the internet has very successfully done. It's enabled us to actually pick things that we want. But it's also, I think, also a deeply emotional conduit. You know, most of us now book our holidays online because we get a sense that you can see where you're going and you can connect in a way that most of us never felt you could before. Mm. So without a doubt, the continued growth of information communication technology will have an enormous effect on that. And when we start moving into the growth of virtual worlds, it'll get a whole lot more exciting, I think.
Virtual worlds.
Yeah, I mean, we're at a point now where most of us have just got used to using probably the internet. I mean, despite the age of everyone in this room, I would say that probably less than 10% of this room have registered or been on Second Life or MySpace, for an example. So they have no understanding. Am I wrong or am I right? Who's here has visited Second Life? Anyone? 1, 2, 3, 4. There you go. Less than 10%. MySpace? Oh, good. Okay. So we're beginning to understand the value of social networking sites. Great. And the influence that they have on people and how that's affecting a whole new generation of consumers, their ability to actually be federated in very different ways, to be very networked. Social networking sites is obviously the big thing of the moment, which is why Murdoch was bought into it, why Bebo, MySpace, all those sites are hugely successful. But most of us in this room, we go on and we look, we don't actually engage. We are not networking with the wrong generation. Because we are part of the enormous digital divide that exists out there, which is that we sit on one side, regardless of whether you're kind of 65 or 35 or even probably 25, we're all on that side of the divide. We still see the internet as a glorified yellow pages. It's there for downloading. We extract, we steal, and we take. Everyone under 25, as a rule of thumb, does totally the reverse.
What do they do?
The internet is about uploading, it's about sharing, it's about collaborating, it's about engaging, it's about creating. Everything that exists for them in terms of space is about the ability to share things and do things with other people. This is why television advertising just will really not exist within 5 or 10 years, certainly for a youth market, because young people are going to stop watching television more or less. Because all of their forms of activity will occur online. Why am I going to watch a television program created by a 40-year-old in which everything has been predetermined and defined when I can go to a virtual world and live a fantasy with my friends and actively engage in it and play it and be it? You know, it's why? Why? You know, that kind of form of organized entertainment will just become, you know, for that generation, I think, will become just anathema. So the growth of virtual worlds, which again, clearly a lot of us aren't quite getting into yet, we still think of them as games. You know, we grew up with this idea that the computer game was about kind of Game Boys or Nintendo. So, you know, a lot of us have been on Sony PlayStation and think it's just a game. But that's where it's about points and prizes. What you get with virtual worlds is the notion that you can enter a created community where you can be as far removed from yourself or as like yourself as you choose. Again, that's not really the issue. This issue of whether it's real or unreal, or whether people are being true or false, it's by the by. It's the fact that people are actually engaging with other human beings in real time, in created communities, where there is a sense of interaction, where there is a sense of community being created, where there are things going on, exciting stuff.
Mm.
And one of the things we think most interesting is the huge potential that virtual world sites offer to brands, in a way that social networking sites don't. because social networking sites are actually something that we've created for ourselves in the spirit of Tim Berners-Lee, who created the internet. But it's not a place for brands. We don't want our brands to be involved in social networking sites because they muddy the water. You know, it's about us. It's about personality. Virtual worlds are about totally different worlds in which there may or may not be a space for shops, for shopping malls, for brands, for advertising, for a whole new generation of status product. Mm. It just so happens that it's virtual.
Mm.
And I was with Land Rover in San Francisco 3 weeks ago, and they've begun to understand that, you know, in a matter of very short space of time, there will be people who will be prepared to pay thousands of dollars for a virtual Land Rover that they drive around their virtual spaces in, because that's what they want to do, and to be the person that's got the Land Rover. You know, that the status aspiration is no different than it is in the real world. You know, I might not be able to afford a suite of Louis Vuitton luggage in real life, but I might be able to in Second Life.
Mm.
And I might be able to wear clothing with those brands, with that attachment.
Mm.
So the same, you know, it's going to get very, very interesting.
Does that mean that there are essentially two groups? Because one would imagine that there are shades of grey in between.
Yeah, of course. And we'll adapt. You know, I mean, how long before you... I remember I had a conversation with this after I'd spoken about Second Life quite recently at a design conference in LA, and the woman kind of said, oh, I've been on Second Life, and I really don't like it. You know, I like reading Jane Austen. I said, great. Imagine being in a Jane Austen novel. Imagine a Second Life for Jane Austen addicts, where you were surrounded by Darcys. And it was set in the pump house in Bath, and everything was about balls and dancing and tea and with the vicar, because that's what a virtual world could be. It could be this glorious English 19th century, you know, pastoral bliss where you float around in little muslin frocks. Who's to say it can't be? You know, who's to say that Second Life can't be rainbow life where you have to be over 65? That's the point. That's the possibility. It's endless, you know. That's why it's all about creativity, because suddenly the boundaries are only caused by your own imagination, and designers are suddenly understanding that they can build and build and build on Second Life and need never actually throw up a brick anymore, but they can build the most beautiful houses and buildings, you know, that they'll never be able to build anywhere else.
You're talking about human desire here. And Maynard Keynes talked about the relationship between economies and human desire.
Yeah.
And essentially that economies mapped desire.
Well, economy only really exists because of human desire.
Has that always been the case?
Well, yeah, pretty much. I think, you know, the basis of our civilization is shopping.
Go on.
Well, you know, and if you've got the need to actually have something, to acquire something, you have to actually exchange it for something else. So the whole process of actually moving from a cave was that mapping of actually being able to go through a process of acquisition.
Hmm.
That actually I produce something that has enough value that I can trade with something else to stop me doing something, or to have some gold to put around my own neck or the neck of my wife.
Hmm.
It was about that sense of both status and that sense of, as I said, acquisition, in order to make your life easier.
Mm.
And so everything that we've done as human beings is based around that process of acquisition.
Have some of us got it wrong in terms of the relationship between desire and the economy, i.e. our pursuit of...
I don't think so. I just think we need to stop letting the number crunchers have their way. You know, and
any number crunchers in the room?
Just to, you know, to actually remember that, you know, there is nothing rational about the process of consumption. You know, watch a dad take his kids to a supermarket on a Saturday and watch rationale go out of the window.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it's all about satisfaction. It's all about, you know, satisfying yourself, the people around you, the people you love.
Mm.
You know, and there is nothing rational. Even when you come to try and make the most astute purchases, whether it be the house that you live in or the car, those really big, important, life-crunching decisions.
Mm.
I bet most of us who have bought and owned our own house made the decision to buy that house in about 10 seconds. And in fact, the agonizing about it afterwards was just to try and find the right reasons to explain why we wanted to buy that house.
Okay. Let's come closer to home. Home for us, not
okay.
necessarily for you. What comments can you make generally or specifically about Australia and Australians? And be frank.
Well, I don't know. I've got a bit of a... I've been banging on about this for some time. I've still got a bit of a bee in my bonnet that I'm bored with bored culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wish you Aussies would get on and come up with something else. Mainly, I mean, I had to be, you know, I've got a vested interest. I used to work for Quicksilver. So I just think, because you did such a fantastic job of changing lifestyle culture around the world, you know, 10, 20 years ago, and the effects of that are still being felt. You know, it didn't. You know, surf culture did not come from California. You know, it came from Australia, and the effect that that's had on not just youth culture, obviously, because we're talking about people in their 40s now, is still enormous. I don't think Australia realises that quite how enormous the impact of it has been, and that the rest of the world is kind of waiting for them to come up with the next good idea, and we're still waiting.
So that's it. That's a contribution.
Yeah, just as an observation, I think that's one, which is that, you know, I think it's not that the world has looked to Australia to generate trends. It's just that they have kind of slipped in under the radar because they've been so acceptable, they've been so successful, they've been so amenable. You know, whereas other trends kind of hit you between the eyes and they're supposed to have a huge effect. You know, the whole kind of idea of the Australian lifestyle, the way Australians prepare food, cook food, you know, the way that it's actually about a very appropriate way of living, I think, a lot of the time, I think has had a huge effect in both Europe and the States.
Is this the modern Australian, the mod Oz?
Mod Oz, yes, I call
approach?
It. Approach? Yeah.
And what does it represent to people outside Australia?
I think there's a sense of freedom attached to that and republicanism, dare I say.
Okay.
You know, again, it's very federated. It's very flat. You know, at a time where we're still in, you know, certainly in British and American systems, very hierarchical.
Yeah.
And there isn't that sense when you come to Australia.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, which is about being forward-thinking. You know, but at the same time, obviously, you know, most of us are aware that there's a society going on here that can be incredibly blinkered and very, very short-sighted. You know, so there's a very interesting contradiction going on, I think.
I'll come back to Australia and Australians in a moment.
Mm.
A conversation about the future is incomplete without some comment about China and India in terms of how those nations are evolving.
Yeah.
What's your view there in terms of particularly trends and creativity?
I mean, I could recite some of the figures, but you probably know them all as well as I do in terms of when the BRIC nations, Brazil, Russia, India and China, overtake the rest of us sad G6 members. I think we've got about 30 years left in terms of being economic powerhouses. For me, I think one of the things that we've probably grossly underestimated is the amount of time it will take, certainly China and India, to actually start producing credible brands themselves. And also, more importantly, outputting creative talent that will not just come and work for us, but will actually generate creativity in their own countries. You know, we understand, of course, that they're manufacturing super hubs and that they're great service offshore providers. But I think the critical point is we're forgetting the fact that, when I was last in Shenzhen, the quality of the work by their graduate students equaled or will equal, I felt, having looked at it, within about 3 or 4 years, that from some, say, Central St. Martin's, you know, the bastion of design in almost around the world. So, in that respect, I think we've got about another 10 years left being, you know, kind of relying on that actually it's not just about the fact that they make the product and do it cheaper. It's the fact that, well, they can get on with doing that. We'll do what we do best, which is, you know, we design it, we come up with the great ideas. And I think, you know, because I think what you're going to see is also, you know, we assume that these countries are just going to develop like us, which again is a complete, absolute rubbish. I mean, why is India going to want to become like Australia? You know, anyone with any understanding of the country knows that India will never be like Australia and never wants to be like Australia in a million years, or Britain, or America. You know, it's uniquely Indian, as is China, with its own kind of cultural, you know, kind of behaviours and ways of doing things. And I think what you'll see is that you know, Indians will start just wanting to buy Chinese brands, Indian brands, and Chinese people the same. And yes, there's always an appeal for the global brand, and that will never go away. But, you know, the development will be that the Chinese brands will actually be more popular for us than other international brands, and that the Chinese will produce Chinese brands that are homemade, homegrown, home-sponsored, home-funded, and, you know, that's where the development will be. So, you know, if we, the sense of offshoring, I think, is something we've got to really start to evaluate. Because I think the other big problem, and I think again with China, because I think China can be so, you know, it can be so specific about things the way it wants. I think there will come a point, especially within the special economic zone in Shenzhen, that they will suddenly turn around and say, do you know what, we are not going to produce your crap anymore. Take it somewhere else. We're not going to make any of those, you know, 50-cent T-shirts anymore. Find some other place to make them. We've got better stuff to do. We're making quality work now.
What does it say for a country like Australia?
Well, it's a challenge like it is for anywhere else in the developed world because it's about understanding what your strong points are, what you can deliver and how that fits into a global landscape as well as a national one. I think one of the problems Australia has is that it has more brands that it can actually support, I think, given its current size. Certainly within an area of my expertise here, which is within the fashion business, so there are way too many brands here for the size of the market. And I think you'll see quite a lot of collapse go on in that area over the next couple of years. And I think that the discounting thing will get worse before it gets better.
Discounting?
Yeah.
You're talking about department store?
Well, there's just, there is a real discount culture here, isn't there? And I think there comes a point where product becomes so valued, devalued, that it has no internal value to itself, and who's paying the cost for that? And those questions will need to get answered. And I think at this point, Australia still as a country it hasn't got the best record in the world in terms of environmental sustainability or recycling. Let's face it. In fact, I think you're second worst in the world in these areas, which is pretty frightening for a kind of, you know, a clever, forward-thinking country. But I think those issues will face you pretty quickly with climate change. So you'll come up with some really nifty solutions, I should think, very quickly.
You touch on this issue of climate change, which is essential in this conversation. What do you see happen in terms of climate change and our response to it?
We have done no forward-thinking planning in terms of or tried to do any projections or analysis on the effects of climate change because that's not our area. We can't.
Okay.
We're not scientific enough. What we have looked at, a lot of what the current issue viewpoint is about consumers' reaction to and how that will develop to what they have read and where our society is going with respect to views on climate change, environmental sustainability, and recycling, and a more ethical view on products and the development and the production of product. Do you see the difference?
Sure.
So for us, the issue is called, our viewpoint is themed, every issue is a different theme. We called it new austerity. We were interested in looking at how all sorts of things that we were picking up, whether it be about designers wanting to pare back and simplify, to a mood that we were seeing in architecture, to trends that we were seeing with brands and consumer behavior, to this notion that a lot of us as consumers were getting to the point where we were saying, do you know what? I have enough stuff. I don't need anything else. So I'm going to focus on actually thinking about when I buy something, maybe where it's come from, because I no longer have to think just about how much it cost me. I've got enough money now to actually be able to make judgments about what I buy. And 2 years ago, that might have just been about, is it a brand? And therefore, is that about status? Is that showing I've arrived? But now I've already arrived, so in fact I'm able to make decisions about, well, you know, tell me a little bit about this product. Does it say the right things about me as a person? You know, where has it come from? Who was involved in manufacturing it? How did it get here? How much does it cost? What were the hidden costs involved in this product? A lot of the awkward questions that brands don't like us asking. But as consumers, we're spending more and more time asking those questions because they're implicit in the value that we place on products. You know, food is a perfect example, and supermarkets have been ahead of the curve in this for a long time. You know, buying food is now not just a nutritional issue, it's a moral issue. The food that I put on my kids' plates is a moral issue.
So there's a significant shift here in terms of behaviour in response to people's perceptions of what the world will become and their contribution to it.
Yeah, because the one of the most exciting things, again, that happened over the last 5 years that was so exciting most of us didn't even realise it, was that we suddenly realised, again, as human beings, each of us has a voice, and that that voice matters.
Mm.
Because one of the things that seemed to happen after the post-war period was that our sense of politics and political importance for a lot of us in developed worlds went into decline, because we saw economies that were doing very well, we were very comfortable, we were able to go through rampant periods of expansion and the ability to buy more for ourselves, to get more comfortable. And so we stopped asking difficult questions, both from a political perspective, but also in terms of evaluating our individual power, because it was all about actually joining groups and about actually evening out the gaps.
Mm.
So your desire as a human being was to fill in the gaps, to actually make society more kind of equal to some extent.
Mm.
And what we saw as the 90s began to end and the noughts started again was people began to realise that, in fact, their voice made a difference, that their vote could make a difference, that by actually deciding not to buy something, it would have a difference for a brand, that by actually taking part in a demonstration about America's invasion of Iraq would make a difference.
Mm.
So we did suddenly see people demonstrating again. We saw people understanding the importance of hanging a flag outside their front door. All sorts of just often small signs or acts of demonstration that were about showing that I can make a difference.
Mm.
And everything, again, about being connected through internet culture and internet communities, and the ability that more and more of us have to engage in that community, is about the power of one.
Mm.